held only a long couch, a flat-screen TV, and a low table with a closed laptop computer on it. He led her to the kitchen, which was small and windowless, but looked recently renovated. Between the counters and the cabinets, the walls were lined with a pattern of black, white, and green tiles. He filled two glasses with tap water and passed her one. They drank in silence. Then he said,
"I suppose either we both take showers or neither of us does."
Feeling a minor appreciation for his willingness to assume the role of host, she shook her head. "I need to be back at my parents' house before dinner. I will pee, though. Do you have a condom?" He nodded. In the modern, clean bathroom, after urinating, Liz washed her hands and splashed water on her face, though more to cool off than establish hygiene. In the bedroom, which contained a king-sized bed covered with a gray cotton spread, a nightstand, and a lamp, Darcy was seated on the floor, still in his shirt and shorts, with one leg stretched out and his torso extended over it. Liz walked to him and held out a hand, and he took it and stood. Uncertainty then presented itself. And no doubt if she had been 18, or probably even if she'd been 28, she'd have looked to him to banish this confusion. But she was 38. She had orchestrated the encounter, and so she said, "I'm thinking it's more efficient if we both take off our own clothes. Do you care about getting sweat on your sheets?" He seemed to find the question funny.
"They're washable."
Thus, standing a few feet apart, they stripped. She avoided looking at him, except that she snuck a few glances. He was hairier than she'd have guessed, though not in a bad way, and while she'd known he was fit, he was practically sculpted. If she'd previously realized just how perfectly muscled he was, she might have been too intimidated to make this overture. Then his body was pressed up against hers. They were kissing. Never having participated in hate sex, she was glad to learn kissing was part of it. And the naked standing-up kissing went on for a while, accompanied by roaming hands, and at some point, an air conditioner kicked on with a forceful whirring. And after another interval, a cacophony of car horns was audible through the apartment's closed windows. Out in the sunny evening, populated by people who weren't, for the most part, kissing each other while standing up naked. Then either he nudged her toward the bed or she pulled him, and soon after that he removed the condom from the drawer of his nightstand. All in all, the experience was highly satisfying, certainly for her, and judging by external clues, it seemed reasonable to conclude for him as well. Without question, it was far more enjoyable than prom night with Philip Haley or most other couplings she'd partaken of in the 20 years following. Indeed, one sign of just how agreeable she found the interaction was that she was only vaguely aware of the identity of the person with whom she was sharing it. At the beginning, the preposterousness of this proximity to Darcy, Fitzwilliam Darcy, had distracted her, and then again at the end, as she emerged from the delirious haze in which they'd mutually collapsed. It was as she returned to herself that it occurred to her to wonder whether what they were doing counted as cuddling. Surely, even if hate sex permitted kissing, cuddling was a violation. She rolled away and sat up, reaching to find her clothes on the floor. She could feel his gaze but waited to look at him until she was fully dressed in her damp and reeking shirt and shorts. Finally, making eye contact, she said, "I'll let myself out." As it happened, they had never made it under the bedspread, but instead conducted their entire transaction atop it. In that moment, both his hands were set behind his head, and his long, hairy, muscular body was exposed. There was on his face an expression difficult to read, and she felt determined not to blush. "See you around," she said. Was he amused? Perturbed? Bewildered? It was impossible to know.
"Indeed," he replied.
Chapter 88. Liz was writing a check from her bank account to the contractor when she received the text from Jasper. The contractor had scraped away the bubbling, flaking paint from the water stain in the living room, then covered the wall with primer and a coat of mustard-colored paint from the can Liz had, to her surprise and delight, unearthed during her basement excavations. The source of the water stain, the contractor informed her with such reticence that it occurred to Liz he feared offending her by drawing attention to her stupidity, was that the roof gutters were all overflowing with leaves, which created flooding during rainstorms.
"Keeping your gutters clean is a good thing to do," he said gently.
In its entirety, Jasper's text said, "Awesome," and provided a link to an article about a man in Nebraska who had unsuccessfully tried to shoplift a snake from a pet store. Jasper was taking her temperature, Liz knew. He wanted to see where things stood between them. She didn't respond. Chapter 89. Shane's colleague's clients were scheduled to visit the tutor between 2 and 3 on Monday afternoon, which meant the house's inhabitants needed to be elsewhere. After arranging for Mary to take their father to the mercantile library, "I already did that last week," Mary said, and Liz said, "Exactly. It's called pulling your weight." Liz had requested that Lydia, Kitty, and Mrs. Bennett accompany her to the Kenwood Mall to help her select an outfit in which to interview Kathy DeBerg. This seemed to Liz such a transparently obvious excuse that she was surprised by how readily they agreed to it. She was inside a dressing room, wearing a blue wraparound dress, when, at 2:25, which was far earlier than she'd expected, she received a call from Shane.
"They love it," he said. "They're making an offer tonight, which obviously will be contingent on the inspection."
Looking at herself in the mirror, her dark hair, the expensive dress that didn't belong to her, her bare legs and feet, Liz actually smiled. "Thank you, Shane," she said. "This is such great news." Chapter 90. It wasn't that Liz had changed her mind about Darcy's essentially disagreeable nature. Rather, she had concluded that a romp or two in his bed would neither diminish nor exacerbate his disagreeability, especially if she discussed it with no one, even Jane. 24 hours after their initial coital encounter, she went for another run fully prepared to see him. So prepared, in fact, that she was surprised not to see his imposing figure at East Hill Avenue, then surprised at Observatory Avenue, at Menlo Avenue, at Stettinius Avenue. And by Edwards, she had to admit to herself that the chances of crossing paths with him had grown slim. Really, she had little idea of either his work schedule or his exercise routine. The question then was how deliberate to be. Whether to dispense altogether with pretenses of coincidence, track down his email or phone number, and arrange another meeting using the same specificity she'd employ to make a dentist appointment. The antipathy she and Darcy felt for each other meant the sacrifice of pride such a plan would entail was simultaneously more and less consequential than if they shared mutual fondness and respect. She returned to the tutor without either laying eyes on him or coming to a conclusion about what her course of action ought to be. And thus, in more than one way, she was deeply frustrated. Chapter 91. The names of the prospective buyers were Jacqueline and Adam Whitman, and they offered the Bennetts $915,000 for the tutor, which offended Mrs. Bennett so keenly that she took to her bed immediately upon hearing the figure. Shane had emailed a scanned copy of the offer to Liz as dinner was concluding, and the amount had left Mrs. Bennett unable even to watch television in the den. She needed to manage her distress from a prone position. "You'll end up meeting them somewhere in the middle," Liz said from the doorway of her mother's room. "This isn't the last word."
"Leave me be," her mother replied. "You've done enough
damage.
Chapter 92. At Mr. Bennett's appointment with his orthopedist, Dr. Facciano said,
"You seem to have regained a full range of motion. Any pain?" "Only the emotional kind inflicted by my children," Mr. Bennett said.
"Does that mean he can drive again?" Liz asked.
"I don't see why not,"
Dr. Facciano said.
"Wow," Liz said.
"Aren't you thrilled, Dad?"
"I am," Mr. Bennett said, "because now your last excuse for not returning to New York has been obviated."
"I'm staying until Mom's luncheon," Liz said, and her father rolled his eyes.
He said, "Then for that, you have no one to blame but yourself."
Chapter 93. During her evening run, which had replaced her morning run, just before Liz turned from Grandin Road onto Madison Road, which was to say, not before she'd begun speculating about whether she'd see Darcy, but before she'd reasonably expected that she would, there he was. Tall and composed and minimally sweaty, presumably thinking supercilious thoughts, but looking so unjustly handsome as he did that all her internal organs lurched a little. His real self, his actual physical body before her, as opposed to the tempting yet irritating idea of him, was somehow a surprise. In as blasé a tone as she could manage, she said, "How are people's brains today?"
"If I'm seeing them, not good."
He was running in place, waiting for Liz to catch up to him. And when she had, he began running next to her. She said, "You know how everyone says it's not brain surgery? Do you and your colleagues say, 'This is kind of hard, but hey, it is brain surgery'?" The look on his face prompted her to add, "Am I the millionth person to ask you that?"
"You aren't the first."
As they continued north on Madison Road, he added,
"I've been meaning to tell you that my sister is a fan of yours. It turns out she's subscribed to Mascara for years, and when I told her I'd met someone who works there, she knew immediately who you were."
"She must have excellent taste."
"Georgie is very intelligent. She's a PhD student in history."
"Do you dare tell me where she goes to school, or will I faint?"
"I knew you'd say something like that. She's at Stanford."
Liz pressed the back of one hand to her forehead. "Get my smelling salts." She glanced at him. He appeared to be only mildly amused, if that, and said, "Seriously, tell her thank you for me. We at Mascara love our smart readers. Is your sister planning to be a professor?"
"If she can find a job out there. She's a bit of a homebody."
"Is she younger than you?"
"Significantly. She's only 26.
"And does she literally still live at home? Keep in mind that for once I can't pass judgment given my own sisters."
"My parents are deceased. Georgie lives in..."
"I'm sorry," Liz interrupted, and rather stiffly Darcy said,
"It's all right."
As they crossed Bedford Avenue, he added,
"My father was older than my mother and passed away when I was in high school and Georgie was 3. Our mother passed away 5 years ago. Georgie went to Stanford for undergrad, too, and she was living on campus at that point, which she still is, but she's never wanted to give up our parents' house. I don't think she goes there when I'm not in town, but she's very attached to it."
"Do you want to sell it?"
"It's on 12 acres, and it's just sitting there. Someone might as well enjoy it."
"You grew up in the Bay Area, right?" Liz tried to sound casual. Had he really just said 12 acres? Matter-of-factly, Darcy said,
"In Atherton."
And Liz then understood what she previously hadn't bothered to consider. It wasn't astonishing that Darcy came from an affluent family. Both his education and bearing had provided clues, but it hadn't occurred to her that his affluence was so extreme. She could hardly guess in this day and age at the value of such a property in such a place. $30 million? 40? Personality aside, he really was almost freakishly eligible. She said, "Is there still furniture in the house?" He nodded. "A couple lives on the grounds in their own cottage. Our caretaker, Roger, and his wife. Georgie and I go back a few times a year. It's really a house for entertaining, so unless we're having a bunch of guests, it's kind of depressing. I prefer to sleep on a futon in Georgie's apartment."
How had Liz not Googled Darcy prior to this moment? And no wonder Caroline Bingley was pursuing him. Not that his fortune made him more appealing to Liz. If it were only money she was after, she might have reciprocated her cousin's interest. She thought of Darcy's spare apartment, his fondness for $7 meals at Skyline, and then she thought of having divulged to him her family's financial troubles. If she'd known more about his background, she might not have. But since she already had, she said, "My parents got an offer on their house yesterday, from the first people who looked at it."
"Congratulations."
"Well, it's low. But my point is that if they had the choice of holding on to that house forever, they would, and so would my sisters."
"You wouldn't?"
"No, but as my dad told me, I'm cold-blooded."
"It sounds suspiciously like you're bragging."
"Are you working tonight?" Liz asked.
"I go in at 8.
"Then should I come back to your apartment now, or what?" At this, Darcy actually laughed, which was a sound Liz had heard so few times that it was jarring.
He said, "You certainly should."
Chapter 94. In the driveway of the Tudor, the back of Ham's SUV was open, its interior stuffed with boxes topped by several dresses laid flat, still on their hangers. No one was outside, but as Liz stretched in the grass after her return from Darcy's apartment, Lydia emerged carrying a stack of Seven Hills yearbooks and an earring rack, followed by Ham carrying a laundry basket full of folded clothes.
"Are you moving out?" Liz asked Lydia.
"Your ability to pick up on very subtle clues is impressive," Lydia said. "Have you ever thought of being a detective?"
"The way you two bicker," Ham said. "I'm going out on a limb here because I've never had a sister, but it's got to be an expression of love."
Without waiting for Lydia or Liz to respond, Ham added,
"Liz, once we get Lydia unpacked, we want to have you over to our place for dinner."
"Great," Liz said. "And good luck with your new roommate, Ham." Ham smiled.
"I believe I'm up to the challenge."
Chapter 95. A women's league meeting impelled Mrs. Bennett from her bed after a 36-hour period. And while she was up and about, she grudgingly agreed to see a condominium in a 20-story building that she began disparaging before climbing from the car.
"I'd never live so close to the highway," she told Mr. Bennett, Liz, and Shane. "I don't know how anyone sleeps a wink with cars zooming by at all hours."
"The good news," Shane said, "is that every place we see, even if you don't like it, will help us narrow in on what you do want."
Thus, they still toured the unit. And while standing in the master bathroom with her mother, Liz said, "With the influx of money from selling your house, this seems like the perfect time to draw up a budget. You can decide, okay, I'm allotting X dollars per month for ordering stuff from catalogs, and if I exceed that amount before the month ends, I won't buy anything else." Mrs. Bennett gave her daughter a withering look.
"I know perfectly well what a budget is, Elizabeth."
While gazing at herself in the mirror, Mrs. Bennett added,
I hope Lydia's not making a mistake moving in with Ham. You know what they say about when men get the milk for free. Except that he's supporting her. She hasn't even tried to get a job.
Liz's comments seemed to please Mrs. Bennett.
Lydia's such a pretty girl, she said approvingly.
Chapter 96. Fitzwilliam Darcy Atherton, California. Liz typed into Google. And after reading through the results, she tried sequentially Fitzwilliam Darcy Harvard Medical School, Fitzwilliam Darcy University of Cincinnati Comprehensive Stroke Center, and just for the hell of it, Fitzwilliam Darcy girlfriend. She determined that he used neither Facebook nor Twitter, and while he wasn't entirely without an online presence, it was a mostly factual one. His bachelor's degree from Stanford was in biochemical sciences, and also from Harvard, he held a PhD in neuroscience. When had he had time to acquire a PhD? He'd won a number of obscurely named awards at the American College of Surgeons 44th Annual Meeting, the Rothman T. Barnett Resident Prize, and authored or co-authored several even more obscurely titled articles published in medical journals. Modulation of brain stimulation on the interaction between ventral and dorsal frontoparietal and basoganglia cortical networks during expectation and reorienting. In his photo on the Stroke Center website, he wore both a tie and a white coat. Rather more titillatingly, his family's estate in Atherton was called Pemberley. It was located at 1813 Pemberley Lane, though Liz guessed the estate name to predate the street name, and its value was estimated at, variously, $55 million, $65 million, or $70 million. The search for Fitzwilliam Darcy girlfriend bore no fruit. Chapter 97. Adjusting to life in Rhinebeck, Jane reported to Liz by phone, had been nearly seamless. Lydia's assertion notwithstanding, Amanda and Prisha were treating her as a friend rather than an employee. Their son, Gideon, was charming, and Jane had discovered a delicious vegan bakery, which, unconstrained by worry about weight gain, she walked to each afternoon for muffins and slices of pie. She felt a lingering sadness about Chip, she conceded, but such melancholy would exist wherever she was and had, if anything, been diminished by the change of scenery. "And meanwhile, you've managed to sell the house in the blink of an eye," she said. "You're amazing." "It's Shane who sold it, and it's not official until the closing," Liz said. "Whatever," Jane said. "It's a fantastic house. Have you been in touch with Jasper?"
"He's texted me a few times, but I haven't answered."
"Good for you, Lizzie."
Though it crossed Liz's mind to mention cavorting with Darcy, Jane's mood was too cheerful, and her faith in Liz's strength of character too recently affirmed to make the disclosure seem appropriate. Instead, Liz said, "Tell Amanda and Prisha hi from me."
Chapter 98. Kitty was doing push-ups on the floor of her room when Liz paused in the doorway. "You and Mary should start looking for an apartment," Liz said. "The inspection of this house is tomorrow." As Kitty silently continued her push-ups, her form was excellent. A framed photograph set on the mantel of Kitty's fireplace caught Liz's eye. Liz crossed the room to examine it and found that the photo, which was about 2 by 3 inches, was of Mervetta and Kitty. The older woman who was seated wore a yellow skirt suit and matching yellow straw hat, and Kitty was crouched next to her in a sleeveless dress, both of them smiling. "When was the picture of you and Mervetta taken?" Liz asked. From the floor, Kitty said, "Her 70th birthday." "Where was it?" "Her son's house, Bond who?
Did anyone else from our family go?
Dad.
How rare it was, Liz thought, to be surprised in a good way by the members of her family.
Did you and Dad go to Mervetta's funeral?
Liz asked. Kitty still hadn't looked up.
Of course, she said.
Chapter 99.
The least Helen Lucas could do, Mrs. Bennet said as Liz descended the staircase in her running clothes, is thank me for introducing my nephew to her daughter. I'll tell you what. Finding a man willing to date a young lady that size is no easy feat.
Was it possible that in Mrs. Bennet's mind two mutually exclusive narratives coexisted? The belief that Liz had made a dreadful error in spurning Willie, and the belief that she, Mrs. Bennet, deserved credit for the match between Willie and Charlotte?
It appeared so.
Liz had reached the front door and said,
I'm going for a run.
Did you send a message on the computer to Alan Bausch yet? He'd be so pleased to reconnect with Mary.
I don't think Mary wants anything to do with him.
It's worth a try. You just never know.
No, Liz said. That's not true. Sometimes you do know.
Chapter 100.
That night we met, Darcy said, at the Lucas's house. When I told you the chair next to me was taken, Dr. Lucas had asked me to save a seat for him. He never sat in it, but I couldn't have ignored the request of my host, who also happens to be one of the directors at the hospital where I see patients. I wasn't being rude to you for the sake of being rude.
I hope that's been weighing on you all summer. Liz was naked, though only recently so, as was Darcy. He was lying on the bed on his back, his head elevated by two pillows, and she was sitting on him, her legs straddling his waist. Again, they had met by semi-coincidence rather than specific plan. They still hadn't exchanged cell phone numbers or email addresses.
When I overheard you trashing me, my family, and Cincinnati, Liz said, was that also because you didn't want to offend Dr. Lucas? I'm sure you must have been showing your good breeding somehow, because it couldn't have been that you were just acting like an asshole.
Touché, Darcy said.
Both his hands rested on both her hips, and there was something ludicrous and suspenseful, pleasingly ludicrous and suspenseful, about having this conversation unclothed prior to the main event. She said, anything else you need to clear the air about?
She'd been kidding, but his expression became serious.
Do you want children?
If you're trying to convince me that we shouldn't use a condom, the answer is absolutely not.
He shook his head. It isn't that. It's a sincere question.
No, she said. I don't want children. The ambivalence she usually feigned during such conversations seemed in this instance unnecessary. She was not, after all, trying to endear herself to him. She said, if you want, I'll give you possible ways to respond, and you can choose the one you like best. A, oh, Liz, you'll change your mind. You just haven't met the right person.
Before continuing, she raised her eyebrows and tilted her head with fake earnestness.
B, but who will look after you when you're old?
Switching to a scolding tone, she said,
C, yeah, I bet you don't want children, you selfish East Coast narcissist.
Pretending to be concerned, she said,
D, wow, your childhood must have sucked. Or,
for the last one, she reverted to patronizing.
E, you just have no idea how rich and wonderful parenthood can be. In fact, you haven't really lived until you've wrestled a shrieking four-year-old to the ground at Target. Now, keep in mind, Fitzwilliam Darcy, that you can choose all of the above.
That's quite a list, he said. though I think of you as more of a Midwestern narcissist than an East Coast one.
Believe it or not, I do understand why people have kids. For most of my life, I assumed I'd be a mother, and I'm sure it is rewarding when they're not having tantrums. But the older I've gotten, the less I've wanted it for myself. Watching Jane go through her insemination process was the clincher. I like my life now. There's stuff I want to do in the future that isn't compatible with having kids. And it's not even a big, tortured decision. It's a relief.
What do you want to do that's not compatible with motherhood?
Liz shrugged. Travel, write a book, run a marathon, be a super doting aunt without having to deal with things like potty training.
I don't want children either.
Really?
She was genuinely surprised. He smiled slightly.
Which reason do you think applies to me?
You'd know better than I would.
When I went into neurosurgery, I was making a choice that either I'd be the kind of person who lets his partner do 95% of the parenting, or I wouldn't be a parent, period. Anyone who claims that surgeons pull their weight in their own families is lying. The hours make it impossible. And for me, that's before you factor in research. And yes, I've heard the argument that not having children is selfish, but that's ridiculous. If you really want to do something unselfish, adopt a 7-year-old black boy from foster care. I assume you'll make fun of me for saying this, but I believe the skill set I have means I can contribute the most to society as a scientist and doctor. Any man with a viable sperm count can become a dad, whereas only some people can perform a decompressive craniectomy.
Why would I make fun of you for that? Liz grinned. I already knew you were an egomaniac. The truth, however, was that he did not seem egomaniacal to her. He seemed principled and thoughtful. And she felt a vague embarrassment that she worked for a magazine that recommended anti-aging creams to women in their 20s, and he helped people who'd experienced brain trauma. But surely this wasn't the moment to turn obsequious. Aside from disrobing, they hadn't engaged in any additional preliminary activities. Nevertheless, a few minutes earlier she had wondered if he had an erection, and she was now sure that he did. She rocked her hips forward once. "I think it's time to get this party started," she said. And she leaned down and kissed him on the lips. Chapter 101. Shane had warned Liz that the inspection of the tutor could take up to 6 hours. And it was after much deliberation and with much dread that, for the date on which it would occur, Liz had proposed to her parents a day trip to Berea, Kentucky. A town of 14,000, just under 2 hours from Cincinnati, Berea was known for a thriving artistic community that created and sold paintings, sculptures, jewelry, pottery, and weavings. For many reasons, a visit there seemed likely to be a terrible idea. Liz worried that its wares would be too homespun for her mother's taste, and that her mother would impulsively purchase, say, an enormous and expensive bird bath. But for the length of the inspection, the goal was to transport Mrs. Bennett out of Cincinnati and render her incapable of returning to the tutor of her own accord. When Liz broached the topic of Berea with her father, Mr. Bennett said,
"I can scarcely imagine a less tempting invitation."
"Right," Liz said, "but your enjoyment is actually irrelevant." Mr. Bennett chuckled.
"Tell me when we leave."
Mrs. Bennett was only slightly more cooperative. "Deb Larson commissioned a lady in Berea to make a hooked rug that looks like their house in Michigan," she said. "The likeness is amazing." But then a scowl came over her face. "Don't think I don't know exactly what you're doing, Lizzie." Before departing, Liz emphasized to Kitty and Mary the importance of staying away from the tutor
until she told them that the inspection had concluded. If you guys are still thinking of getting an apartment together, today would be a good time to look around, Liz said, and Kitty said, Maybe, but I'm going to a rowing class Ham teaches at 11. Liz's contingent used Mrs. Bennett's car. Liz drove, her father rode in front, and her mother sat in back. It was a relief to Liz to take on the role of chauffeur, both because her parents were awful drivers and because Liz had always felt profoundly uncomfortable spending two-on-one time with them. So divided had their attention been for so many years that on the rare occasions when it wasn't, something felt wrong. There was too much opportunity for scrutiny and uninterrupted conversation. In the interest of avoiding both, Liz had checked out of the Hyde Park Branch Library an audiobook she hoped would occupy the narrow overlap of her parents' mutual interests. A 19-hour, 13-CD biography of a robber baron, published 4 years earlier and honored with many literary accolades. The Bennetts were approximately 6 minutes into the first CD when Mrs. Bennett began remarking on topics ranging from the temperature of the car, it was positively icy in the back seat, to the ongoing indignities of selling the Tudor, and besides, what guarantee did any of them have that Shane was trustworthy? Yes. He may have gone to Seven Hills, but there was something about him she didn't care for. She couldn't put her finger on what, but something. To the dullness of the audiobook, for heaven's sake, did the author really expect people to keep track of all those names and who was related to whom and how? To speculation about whether Ham would propose to Lydia by Christmas. Mrs. Bennett would have preferred Lydia's husband to have a steadier source of income. God only knew if CrossFit was one of those fitness fads that would come and go. But he did seem to have enough of a head on his shoulders that if this business went under, he could find employment elsewhere. An hour and 15 minutes in, Mr. Bennett murmured to Liz,
I'll tell you what we're going to do. When we get to Lexington, you'll drop me off at the Art Museum at the University of Kentucky. You'll pick me up 3 hours later. What you and your mother choose to do in the interregnum is up to you.
Thus, Liz and Mrs. Bennett ended up foregoing Berea for a leisurely lunch at a restaurant called Doodles, where Mrs. Bennett expanded upon several of the subjects she'd introduced in the car, while also sharing in depth the progress of the item solicitation for the Women's League auction. Though Mrs. Bennett conveyed her disappointment at not reaching Berea, her chagrin seemed expressed more than felt. Liz's phone pinged as she was standing outside the front of Doodles, waiting for her mother to use the restroom.
Call me, read the text from Shane.
When she did so, he did not mince words.
Your parents have a spider infestation, he said. We need to get pest control to the house as soon as possible.
Liz winced. An infestation meaning like... She trailed off. Like, how is that quantified?
That's what pest control will determine, but it doesn't look good.
Are the buyers still interested? Liz asked.
No, Shane said. But that's not our biggest problem now.
Chapter 102. Often, on the last day or two before an issue of mascara shipped to the printer, Liz found herself in extremely frequent contact with her editor. A sentence needed to be added to reflect that the actress Liz had profiled had just entered rehab, or that the member of the women's national soccer team was now pregnant. The additional sentence meant that an equivalent number of words elsewhere in the article needed to be cut. Either in person in the offices of Mascara or by text, email, or phone, Liz and her editor would communicate constantly, in an increasingly exhausted and loopy shorthand. And though by the time the article closed, Liz felt utterly sick of whatever it was about, few readers, she believed, had any idea of the amount of work that went into the casual reading experience they enjoyed while riding the subway or taking a bath. When it was all finished, Liz rather missed her editor and their urgent and knowing exchanges. Later, when Liz looked back on what she thought of as the week of fumigation, she felt a similar and perhaps even more surprising nostalgia for her frequent conversations with Ken Weinrich, the proprietor of Weinrich Pest Control and Extermination, and the man who steadfastly guided her on a tour into the unsavory and bewildering world of spider infestation. They first spoke when she was still standing outside Doodles in Lexington, Kentucky. And it was the next morning when he parked his truck in the Bennett's driveway. A sturdy, middle-aged white man, Ken Weinrich entered the house wearing a short-sleeved, button-down tan shirt, jeans, and work boots, and carrying a flashlight and a clipboard. The intervening hours had represented, without question, the worst night's sleep of Liz's entire life. Even counting elementary school slumber parties, college hookups, and overseas plane flights. For legal reasons pertaining to the former buyer's retraction of their offer on the house, Liz hadn't spoken directly to the person who'd conducted the tutor's inspection. However, the inspector had told Shane, and Shane had told Liz, that he'd found spiders on every floor, including inside fireplaces, ceiling light fixtures, and shower heads, and that they were most concentrated in the basement and attic. For this reason, Liz slept, or tried to sleep, in Lydia's bed. But every few minutes, she awakened convinced that she could feel the tickle of arachnid legs crawling across her skin. The inspector also had told Shane that the violin-shaped spots on the back of dead specimens indicated that the spiders were the brown recluse kind, whose bites were known to cause swelling, nausea, and flesh-eating ulcers. When Ken Weinrich confirmed the species, Liz's first reaction was relief that Jane was gone from the tutor. There were probably, Ken Weinrich estimated, thousands of the spiders hiding in the tutor. Though true to their name, they were mostly reclusive. Not that reclusive, Liz thought as she recalled her various encounters with them during the past 3 months. In retrospect, the evidence was plentiful that calling an exterminator was something she ought to have done during her first week at home. Assuming no rain, the fumigation was scheduled for 2 days hence and would require tarps to cover the house from the outside. Once they were in place, sulfuryl fluoride gas would be released within them, and special fans would circulate the gas. The Bennetts would need to be absent from the property for 3 days. Repeatedly, Ken Weinrich assured Liz that sulfuryl fluoride didn't leave residue, and that not only the Bennetts' furniture, but even their food would all be safe for future use. The cost of the fumigation was $10,000. Mr. Bennett seemed resigned, while Mrs. Bennett met news of the infestation with indignance. Much the way they might have had Liz reported the sighting of a single mouse, neither of her parents appeared all that troubled. "I'm sure it's not thousands of spiders," Mrs. Bennett said. During the fumigation, they would stay at the country club. Liz's sisters, by contrast, were horrified. Though in Lydia's case, the horror contained a rather gleeful undertone, only partially compensated for by Ham's immediate offer to let any Bennetts bunk at his house in Mount Adams. However, that very day, Mary and Kitty found a two-bedroom apartment, just as it happened a few blocks from Darcy's, and Liz was the one to pay the first month's rent and co-sign their lease. Not wishing to risk the transport of spiders into this new living space, Mary, Kitty, and Liz drove to the IKEA 30 minutes north of Cincinnati, where Liz bought each sister a bed and, to share, a couch, a kitchen table, and chairs. She wasn't ignorant of the advantages to her of underwriting their acquisitions. Now beholden, they'd have no choice but to obey the directives she laid out for after her departure from Cincinnati. Among them, instructions about monitoring their father's diet, keeping the tutor in a state appropriate to be visited by Shane, other real estate agents, and their clients, and making themselves available to their mother for miscellaneous errands in the 48 hours prior to the Women's League luncheon. Though the luncheon itself was little more than 2 weeks away, Liz had decided not to remain in town for it. She just couldn't stand Cincinnati anymore. She didn't want to spend another night in the now spidery, soon-to-be chemical-laden Tudor. She didn't want to sleep for 2 weeks on Mary and Kitty's couch. And although she appreciated the offer, she didn't want to move in with Ham and Lydia and watch them kiss and coo and drink kale smoothies. With an abrupt urgency, she wanted to be home, in her home, which was Brooklyn. She wanted to get sag paneer and samosas delivered from her favorite Indian restaurant and eat them alone on her living room couch while reading a magazine, blasting her air conditioner and not defending her lack of a husband. "Do you think it's awful if I go straight back to New York after I interview Kathy DeBerg in Houston?" she asked Jane over the phone. And Jane said, "I'm not exactly in a position to tell you not to." Lying on Mary and Kitty's new $500 couch, Liz couldn't decide whether her behavior as a daughter and sister was exemplary or indefensible. On the one hand, she had in recent days exerted herself to an unprecedented degree to ensure the welfare of her family members. On the other, she would not be waiting even until the aeration state of the fumigation was complete to leave. She'd be in New York in time for Labor Day weekend. And indeed, the main impetus for her flurry of activity was the knowledge of her departure. Chapter 103. The way Liz packed her suitcase and purse was to drive them empty in the trunk of her father's Cadillac from the Tudor to the small lawn in front of her sister's new apartment. Also in the trunk were full trash bags containing her clothes, toiletries, digital recorders, and laptop computer. She knelt in the grass and examined each article of clothing, each item from her DOP kit, to ensure that no spider was clinging to it. She wondered if another resident of the building would complain. It probably looked like she was setting up for a garage sale, but no one did, and she found no spiders. When she'd finished, she carried her full bags into her sister's apartment, relieved that she would never be anyone's mother and thus would never need to pick through the scalp of a child searching in just this way for lice eggs. Chapter 104. Having not seen Darcy for nearly a week, Liz forewent the pretense of a run and simply walked from her sister's apartment building to his and knocked on the door. He didn't answer, but as she left the building, surly about the lack of gratification, she encountered him on his way in, carrying several plastic grocery bags in both hands. "I assumed you were working," she said, and he shook his head.
"I go in tonight at 6. Is something wrong?"
She was deciding how to answer. Was he trying to make her feel foolish? When he added, with some degree of awkwardness,
"Or did you just come over to..." "Ah, right. Come in, by all means."
"Here." She extended her hand. "Give me a few bags." As she followed him back up the stairs, she took a perverse delight in sharing the latest news about her family, though instead of mockingly declaring his lack of surprise that the Bennets were harboring an insect plague of biblical proportions, he said, with what bordered on sympathy,
"Old houses have a lot of issues. That's a shame the buyers retracted their offer."
"Well, Kitty and Mary are your neighbors now," she said. "They're at the corner of Mills Bray and Atlantic, in case you need to borrow a cup of sugar."
"I'm surprised a landlord would rent to two people without jobs."
"It's my name on the lease." They had reached the second floor, and Darcy said as he unlocked his door,
"You're not worried about destroying your credit?"
"Oh, I assume I will, but I don't see what the alternative is." Inside, Darcy put away the groceries, requiring refrigeration, while she sat on a kitchen stool. He offered her a beer and water, both of which she declined. And within 10 minutes, the true reason for her visit had been not only initiated, but, for both parties, successfully completed.
"This so-called hate sex," Darcy said then, "is it the norm for you?"
Their latest encounter, like the earlier ones, had been consummated above the sheets, and they were presently positioned near each other but no longer touching. In order to comply with cuddle avoidance, Liz had rolled away from him and lay, as he did, on her back. Liz laughed.
"If you have to ask if someone's slutty, that probably means the answer is yes."
"That's hardly what I was implying. I just wonder if you find it more expedient. Though you did say you recently got out of a relationship, if I remember correctly."
"No, hate sex isn't the norm for me. But neither is living in Cincinnati. And, as a matter of fact, I'm about to leave. I go tomorrow afternoon to Houston to interview Kathy DeBerg, and I'll fly on to New York from there."
"You're leaving town tomorrow?"
Darcy seemed surprised.
"Don't be too heartbroken," Liz said. "Have you ever tried online dating? If not, you should."
"Have you ever tried online dating?"
"Sure. And I definitely would do it if I lived here."
For a few seconds, Darcy was quiet. Finally, he said,
"Is the person you just broke up with Jasper Wick?"
"If it were, that'd be scandalous, wouldn't it, since he's a married man and a Stanford outcast?"
Liz glanced at her watch. "A part of me is tempted to offer to write your online dating profile, but I'm not sure it's ethical to inflict you on another human woman. It wouldn't be very sisterly, if you know what I mean." She had been teasing, but the expression on his face seemed to be one of genuine displeasure. He said,
"I don't need your help with an online dating profile."
"Fair enough. You do have a PhD, I hear."
Liz swung her legs over the side of the bed and reached for her clothes on the floor. She was fastening the clasp of her bra when she heard Darcy say,
"That tattoo always surprises me."
It was 2 inches by 1 inch, an image of a typewriter on the small of her back. Without turning, she said,
"Want to guess how old I was when I got it?"
20.
"Even worse. 23. The irony is that I thought it was much cooler than a flower or a Chinese symbol. I was declaring my serious ambitions as a writer. But somehow, all these years later, it's never been the right moment to show it to any of the people I've interviewed."
Liz glanced over her shoulder.
"Maybe you should get the Hippocratic Oath on your butt."
"Maybe so," he said.
And Liz felt a twinge of something. She still didn't particularly like him, but it was hard not to wonder if they'd cross paths again.
He tapped his left biceps. "Or the Skyline Chili logo up here."
She had pulled on her shirt and underwear, and she stood, turning to face him as she stepped into her jeans. Presumably, it was the last time they'd see each other before she left town. And this unexpected welling of emotion, it was gaining rather than decreasing in intensity. Also, rather bizarrely, there was some chance that a few minutes earlier, during what had appeared to be the height of his pleasure, Darcy had uttered the words, "My darling." If this had indeed happened, Liz was confident the utterance had been accidental, and certainly it had been acknowledged by neither of them.
In any case, what was she supposed to do now?
Hug him goodbye like a co-worker?
No, she would not hug him.
"You're way too good for Jasper, if that's who it was," Darcy said.
He seemed simultaneously like a stranger and someone she knew extremely well. There was either an enormous amount to say or nothing at all. She tried to sound light-hearted.
I wouldn't be so sure of that.
Chapter 105.
After I leave town, my parents might tell you they've changed their mind about selling the house, Liz said to Shane. She had met him at Coffee Emporium on Erie Avenue. My mom especially, but don't trust her. If that happens, call me right away.
I appreciate the sensitivity of the situation, Shane said, but this could quickly get beyond the legal scope of what a real estate agent can do.
They want to sell the house, Liz said, or at least my dad recognizes that they have no choice. If they say otherwise, just treat it like static. And the minute you know another agent is planning to show it, call me, I'll call Mary or Kitty, and one of them will make sure it looks okay and get my parents out.
Shane squinted in a way that took Liz a few seconds to recognize as fake casual.
Speaking of Kitty, he said, how old is she?
26.
Liz felt a mercenary and possibly disloyal temptation to add, and if you sell our house, she's all yours. But he hadn't yet asked if she was single. He was wondering, Liz could tell, but he hadn't asked. Chapter 106.
I figured out where Mary goes, Kitty said, and it's hilarious.
Liz had been lying on the IKEA couch in Kitty and Mary's living room, reading a long article on her laptop in the newest issue of the magazine where she and Jasper had once been fact-checkers.
Where?
Liz asked.
Kitty held up car keys. Come with me.
Is it good or bad?
Just come, Kitty said. It's worth it.
They drove through Oakley. This was the route they had followed to the campus of Seven Hills for countless mornings of Liz's life. But instead of continuing to Oaklawn Drive and making a left, Kitty turned right into the parking lot of Madison Bowl.
She bowls? Liz said.
She's in a league. Kitty's voice was thick with amusement. And it's not a hipster league. It's middle-aged fat people.
That's not against the law.
Once you see them, you'll think it should be.
As Kitty pulled into a parking space and turned off the car, Liz said, She's in there now?
I followed her here a few weeks ago. I needed to make sure she wasn't in a satanic cult before we became roommates.
Did you tell her you'd followed her?
Kitty shook her head.
So what's your plan? We go inside and yell surprise at her?
Last time, she changed in her car into a red and black uniform, Kitty said. Don't you think it's weird that she's so secretive about something so dumb?
Because she knew this was how you'd act if she told us.
Kitty had parked near a light pole, and in the sallow illumination it provided, the sisters looked at each other. Petulantly, Kitty said,
You're no fun. You know what, Kitty? You can decide to be a good person. If you're lucky, you have a long adulthood ahead of you, and you might actually be happier if you're nice instead of mean.
I am a good person, Kitty said. But it was with clear resentment that, to Liz's relief, she started the ignition.
Chapter 107.
Liz called Jane from the IKEA couch, and when she told her sister where she was, Jane said,
I'm sorry your last night in Cincinnati isn't very ceremonious.
Whatever, Liz said. This way I'll appreciate the luxury of my Houston hotel room.
I've been thinking about what the extermination man told you, Jane said, and the idea of Mom and Dad eating food that was in the house during the fumigation. It makes me nervous.
What if you move stuff to Kitty and Mary's place beforehand, or just throw it away? Some of Mom's spices are probably from the 80s anyway.
The annoyance Liz felt, it was because she knew Jane was right,
And she also knew that clearing out the many kitchen cabinets plus the refrigerators on two floors would not be an insignificant task. And Ken Weinrich's team was supposed to arrive at the Tudor at 10 the next morning. Liz glanced at the closed door of Kitty's bedroom. Light shone out from the crack, and she could hear the sound of whatever TV show Kitty was watching on her smartphone. Mary was out, presumably still at the bowling alley. Liz would enlist them both, she thought. To Jane, she said, "Want me to send you a picture of the house when it's tented?" "No," Jane sounded dismayed. "I won't if you don't want me to." Liz lowered her voice. "There's something I haven't told you about Darcy." Her wish to confess stemmed less from a moral awakening than from confusion over the uneasiness she'd experienced leaving Darcy's apartment that afternoon. She needed to discuss the oddness of their final encounter. "Do you know?" Jane said before Liz revealed more, and Jane's tone was equanimous rather than bitter. "If it weren't for Darcy, I have a hunch Chip and I would still be together." "What are you talking about?" "The night he broke up with me, one of the things he said was that Darcy didn't think we made a good couple. Chip also said, as if I didn't know this, how much he respects Darcy." An unpleasant alertness had come over Liz. Why would Darcy have disapproved of you and Chip? Who knows? Although I'm sure I could torment myself from now until the end of time, guessing. Jane laughed a little, which seemed to Liz a sign of her sister's progress. Indeed, Jane appeared far calmer about what she was describing than Liz felt. "Anyway, it's not like Darcy's low opinion of our family has ever been a secret," Jane said. "What's the thing you haven't told me about him?" Liz thought miserably of her conclusion, her entirely self-serving conclusion, she realized, that sleeping with Darcy was not wrong. What disloyalty to Jane she'd shown! Surely divulging her trysts to Jane at this juncture, especially when those trysts were now finished, would serve no purpose. Haltingly, Liz said, "That day you fainted when you were at the hospital, I ran into Darcy outside the ER. He helped me figure out where to go." Jane was quiet, seemingly waiting for more. Lamely, Liz added, "I couldn't remember if I'd mentioned that to you." "I do feel like I can see things more from Chip's perspective than I could at first," Jane said. "What if instead of me telling him I was pregnant, he'd told me that another woman was pregnant with his child? Or if, well, the way Amanda and Prisha had Gideon was using sperm from a friend of theirs, a straight friend. If Chip had donated his sperm to a lesbian couple he was close to, no matter how carefully he'd tried to explain it, it would have seemed weird." "Not really. This stuff happens now." "But if you're just getting to know the other person?" "You're being too easy on him." Liz was, however, unsure if she really thought this or merely wished to deflect attention from herself and what she'd almost disclosed. Then she said, "Kitty solved the mystery of Mary's evening outings. Mary doesn't know we know, but apparently she's in a bowling league." "Really?" Jane sounded tickled. "That's so cute." Chapter 108. The doorbell of the apartment, a sound Liz hadn't previously heard, woke her just before 7 in the morning. In the boxer shorts and t-shirt she'd slept in, the shirt was one she'd excavated from her closet at the Tudor, and it read Harvest Fair 1991 across the front, she opened the door. Insofar as she was awake enough to have any such expectations, she assumed it would be the building superintendent or perhaps the landlord. But to Liz's astonishment, it was Fitzwilliam Darcy. Instinctively, she crossed her arms over her braless chest. "What are you doing here?" she said.
You told me your sister's building was at the intersection of Millsbrae and Atlantic.
Darcy's countenance was grim. His skin was unusually pale, and there were pronounced bags beneath his eyes. He wore green scrubs, and Liz suspected he'd driven directly from his overnight shift. They looked at each other. Was she supposed to invite him in? And somewhere nearby, an oriole trilled.
Darcy said, I take it you're still planning to leave town this afternoon?
Yeah, after the epic fumigation. Or after it starts. It won't be finished for 3 days. There was a pause. Then, in a severe voice and without preamble, Darcy said,
I'm in love with you.
Ha ha, Liz said.
It's probably an illusion caused by the release of oxytocin during sex, Darcy continued, but I feel as if I'm in love with you. You're not beautiful and you aren't nearly as funny as you think you are. You're a gossip fiend who tries to pass off your nosiness as anthropological interest in the human condition, and your family, obviously, is a disgrace. Yet in spite of all common sense, I can't stop thinking about you. The time has come for us to abandon this ridiculous pretense of hate sex and admit that we're a couple.
Darcy had delivered this monologue stiffly, while mostly avoiding eye contact. But when he was finished, he looked expectantly at Liz. If she had ever been so bewildered, she could not recall when. And though she understood that his remarks contained some flattering essence, she had never been more insulted. For several seconds, she searched for words and finally said, So this isn't... You're not joking? Or are you?
I'm not joking at all.
Darcy, how could we possibly be a couple? We don't even like each other.
That was at first.